This is Chatter That Matters with Tony Chapman.
My guest today, well, I'm starstruck. I'm a fan of hers. She's a great friend. She's someone I've admired. She reinvents. She's everything you want in a brand, and yet she's a human being powering it. And the best way to describe her is like you describe celebrities in the States. Oh, there's Cher, there's Madonna. Well, in my case, I'd like you to welcome Jeannie, as in Jeannie Becker. Jeannie, welcome.
We're off to a great start. I'm laughing. That's very cute. Thank you.
So wonderful to see you.
Always great to see you.
So I want to begin by just telling a story. So Jeannie and I would go to events over the years, and I had to tell the story because every time I escorted you to an event, first of all, you're the most gracious human I've ever seen. People would like literally fawn. I'd have to step aside. Oh my God, I love you. My mom loves you. My grandma. It doesn't matter what age they said. You're just so generous with your time, no matter who. And I said, well, that's such great humility. What gave you that sense? Because you should actually have an incredible ego for all you've accomplished.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I got into this business because I love people, and that's what's kept me in this business and shall continue to keep me
in this
business.
But you've been fawned over, so, you've had dressing rooms, you had makeup.
Well, that's what we do it for, don't we? I mean, I never could get those stars that, you know, they just want to be alone. Yeah. Or, you know, they don't want to deal with the public, really. You know, they want to be out there, they want the adulation, but when it comes right down to it, you know, they don't have time for you. I've had the incredible privilege, honor, luxury of meeting some of my great childhood idols, even like teen idols, like these, you know, the amazing celebrities that I've met over the years during my course of work. And I have rarely, if ever, been really disappointed by one of my heroes. So I've sort of made up my mind that if someone's going to think of me as one of their heroes, I don't want to disappoint anybody.
Well, I got to tell a funny story. So you and I are going to a TIFF event. And you are stunning, and you're this vintage Wayne Clark.
Oh, Wayne Clark, royal blue Wayne
royal
Clark.
Black, and you're coming down, and you just got these curves, and you're just gorgeous.
On the escalator.
I'm so excited. You're on the escalator. Tell us what happens.
Well, my dress, my flowing chiffon dress, and it also had a big long shawl to go with it, got caught in the elevator.
Escalator.
In the escalator. A nightmare of the highest order, and it was like, I think they have to stop the
escalator. Oh, first of all, the hero, I pushed the stop button.
Oh, okay.
Because I was worried the dress was going to come off completely. And then you were the coolest.
I wouldn't have just like rip it off or something.
No, somebody came up and had a pair of scissors, and this is a vintage dress. Oh, thank you very much. Cut, 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 and off you left. I don't know if the escalator ever worked again. But to me, was the definitive Jeannie moment. Nothing phases you. And that's what I think the overall theme of this interview is, that you constantly reinvent. And I want to sort of wind the tape back, because you and I have chatted before. You came from really humble beginnings, but so rich in values.
Mm. Well, my parents were Holocaust survivors that emigrated here 3 years after the war in 1948, after spending 3 years in a DP camp in Austria. I came here with literally nothing. Well, they did have a wooden trunk that is now in Pier 21, actually, in the museum there. But, you know, they had some eiderdown quilts in it and a couple of teapots or something. So, they came here with nothing, and like phoenixes rising from the ashes, they really rebuilt their shattered lives. They were determined to just go for it. And my dad's motto, what got him through the war, him and my mom, because they were on the run and hiding the whole time. Their entire families were, you know, decimated, perished in the Holocaust. But their motto, my dad's motto certainly, was don't be afraid and never give up. So that's how I was raised. And if you're raised with a dictate that strong and that gutsy and that pure and that passionate, it's the best thing ever, because I was pretty fearless and certainly refused to give up still.
And you know, it was interesting, and you know, maybe we'll just, because we want to move the story, there's so many things I want to talk about, but you know, what I understand, your dad made slippers in the basement, yeah. Right? I mean, that was his...
He started a little slipper factory.
Yeah, and so enterprising, and it's so interesting to see this dedication to improving circumstances in fashion. If you had to say, you know, are you 50-50, your mom and your dad? Is there any ratio in terms of, they say, when you look at yourself in the mirror going, I'm over-indexing them one over the other? Or?
Yeah, no, definitely split down the middle. You know, the really soft part of me, the neurotic part of me, maybe. I think, hopefully, I would not to toot my own horn, but the gracious side of me and the emotional side of me is very much my mom and my dad. You know, the ballsy side of me and the, you know, don't take no for an answer side of me, and the, you know, just the drive in me definitely comes from my dad.
So, you know, I was actually asked this question earlier today in an interview that, you know, the immigrant parents, they're coming and they're doing everything to set up the next life. You know, it's for our children. And often in certainly in the Jewish community, I would say that, you know, lawyer, doctor, professional, you at age 16 decide that's not for me, and I think you started performing.
Oh, I wanted to be in showbiz. I mean, you know, what kid with a TV set growing up in the 50s didn't want to be a TV? That's all I wished for on my birthday cakes every year. I wanted my own TV show. Definitely told my parents that. My mother was fabulous, always very supportive, and sent me to drama lessons when I was 12. And by the time I was 16, I went out there and auditioned. I had an open audition for a CBC sitcom and got the role, even though I had no experience. My mom wasn't too happy initially. It was like, oh, these, you know, get celebrities, they never have happy marriages. You're gonna say, it's a terrible thing to get into. Do you really have to do it? But I think she saw that I really did want to do it, and I got my union card and I started getting commercials and little parts in TV shows and movies. And
but this was all on your own. I mean, it wasn't like you had the helicopter parent that's driving you everywhere. And like, you just...
My parents, you know, spoke, you know, broken English, and it was, yeah, they had no connections whatsoever. So I knew, you know, I'd have to do it on my own, but that's okay. It didn't seem daunting to me. You know, I was, again, it was my dad's voice back of my head always, as it always has been. Don't be afraid and never give up. And I had a kind of chutzpah that just saw me through.
And then at 19, you moved to New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what brought that on? Because that's, you know, that's a sort of a young age, especially, again, you were probably the connective tissue to your parents in Canada, because you knew the English, you had the nuances, you understood the culture. So you leaving must have been quite a vacuum for them to fill.
Oh, yeah. My mother, when I told her I'm going to acting school in New York, you know, she incessantly played. This was 1971. It was the year that Cat Stevens came out with Tea for the Tillerman, and that song, yeah. Oh, baby, baby, yeah. It's a wild world, hard to get by, just don't want to smile. She played that incessantly. She was so freaked out that I was going, but she wanted me to realize my dreams, and they did, you know, help me. I worked all summer long, saved up, you know, $500. She sewed it into my panties because I had a pair of.
Well, that's a
whole other story.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what her mother did when she went to the big city in Poland when she was a young girl. So she said, you know, they'll never get it in your panties. Yeah. I'm going, Mom, that's probably the first place they'll look. I boarded a Greyhound bus. Went to New York, and I didn't know anyone there. I went to the Actors Union office and saw a little sign on a bulletin board that said, you know, young actress is looking for another young actress to share her apartment with, called Jeannie. And I thought, another Jeannie? This is God talking to me. So I did, and, you know, we hooked up with this great girl, and she was going to the same acting school as me, coincidentally. We went to the Herbert Berghoff studio, and it was an amazing time. It was like, wow, I was in New York.
When you think back, because a lot of young people are going to be watching this, and we tend to want to set up these perfectly paved speedways for people. You know, you go to university, you get your job. And what advice can you give to people that just say, go for it, follow that heart, look, find that note with somebody called Jeannie and go, that's intervention.
Well, I don't know if that's old school, new school, whatever, that's the Jeannie Becker school. That's what I would do. I mean, it's not that I didn't try to go to school. And actually, after a year in New York, I came back to enroll in university because I thought, I should get an academic background as well. And I went to theater school there, and that was a crashing bore after having studied in New York. So I took off for Paris to study mime.
Now, I want to talk about that because you're the most gregarious, and mime to me is so much this discipline. What made you What made you think that was because what you were putting in your knapsack?
Because I was craving a discipline.
Yeah.
And because I loved this idea of corporal expression. I mean, I wanted to be a ballerina when I was really young, like 5 years old. You know, I loved dance, I loved movement, and I wanted to communicate. And I wanted to learn an exacting technique. I was sort of, you know, tired of the BS of someone getting a part because of the shape of their nose or the color of their hair, the tone of their voice. I wanted to learn in a technique that, you know, you either created the illusion or you didn't. In mine, there's like, you know, no two ways about it. A very magical kind of form of communication. And it's nothing to do with language. It's universal. I just absolutely fell in love with the purity of the art form. And there was a chance to study with the old man, Etienne de Crewe, who was the master of modern mime, who taught Marcel Marceau, who taught Jean-Louis Barrault. And he was giving classes in his little house in the basement in the Bois de Boulogne. And I just thought, this is the most romantic thing. You know, I was 21. I want to go to Paris and be a real artist.
So let's see some mime.
Okay, how much time do you have?
It's
like riding a bike.
You're giving me a bouquet of flowers.
I'm not gonna start performing for you. That's like saying to a concert pianist who hasn't practiced in, you know, 40 years to like,
you know,
play
you tonight
song.
You're gonna regret not doing some mime for me because I know you. Okay, so you come back from this romantic adventure, and this is what I love about you. You get a job with CBC Radio.
Yeah, the only mime artist in Newfoundland, and I got a job with CBC Radio.
So tell me how do you sell yourself on that?
So I came back from Paris in 1974. 1975, ran off with a love to St. John's, Newfoundland, where he was going to do postgraduate work at Memorial University in folklore, and I was a mime, and I thought, well, maybe I could do mime in Newfoundland, but that didn't, I don't think they really understood, but you know, Ma, you look so pale, my dear. What's the matter, cat got your tongue? Yeah. You know, I don't know if they really got it, but I thought, well, what can I do to parlay my abilities into that? I thought, well, I do know a lot about the arts and a lot about performance art, and certainly St. John's is just a hotbed of creativity for, you know, for artists at, you know, at that time. CBC Radio at that time, interestingly enough, was not doing a lot of arts reportage. It was mostly talking about the fisheries, yeah, and the oil refineries. But there was a consumer show called Radio Noon. And I thought, maybe I could pitch myself as someone who could tell people whether it was worth it to spend $5 on that theater ticket or $10 on that album. Yeah. And I could do reviews and I could interview the, you know, the incredible cast of characters that were all artists living in St. John's at the time. So I knocked on the door of CBC Radio on Duckworth Street, and a cute guy came to the door who had just gotten in charge of a Radio Noon show, a young producer by the name of Johnny Dalton. And I think he probably had the hots for me. I don't know, but he thought I was cute. Whatever.
What happened to the folklore guy?
The folklore guy was still very much there, but you know. I said, you know, I'd really think, you know, I'd love to maybe try to do some radio stuff for you. And he goes, well, like, what do you mean? And I said, well, you know, I could interview. So he said, okay, well, come on and audition. I'm starting the show anew and it's a consumer show, but we'll see if we can work you in. And I did, you know, an interview for him, and he liked it, and it just all worked out. They hired me as a writer-performer, and I was there for 3 years doing, I ended up doing arts documentaries for the network. It was a wonderful time.
And then you come back, and this is where I love that you were part of what I consider one of the great creative meccas that ever exist in Canada, which was Queen Street. Huh. And you started first, I guess, really focusing on music, and then you move more into culture and fashion. So tell us that time in history and you catching this, and not only catching it, but being arguably one of the most important people defining that period in that network.
Well, you know, so I came back in 1978, knocked on every radio station door, had its arsenal of tapes under my arm, that's great. Chum Radio, finally, after 80 million calls to their program director, you know, they let me in, brought me on for an audition. I auditioned with Jungle Jane Nelson, and they hired me on as their good news girl. And that was really wonderful. And that was the same year that City TV was purchased by Chum Radio. And Chum wanted to cross promote their radio personalities on the air. So John Roberts of Fox News Now, who used to be J.D. Roberts, the boss jock at Chum, and me, the good news girl at Chum Radio, got sent over to City TV to host this groundbreaking show called The New Music. Now, you have to remember, this was before MTV was even invented, right? This was 1979. And the only music that had been on TV in that way, you know, Dick Clark's American Bandstand or Top of the Pops, were pop stars would come on and do their shtick and, you know, do an interview or something. But we did a show thanks to the late, great genius, John Martin, who pitched that show to Moses Neimer, another enigmatic genius. A show where we would go on the road with the rock stars, we'd go into their hotel rooms, we'd go into the studios with them, we'd, you know, be backstage with them, we'd just really visit them where they lived, and it was all smash and grab. That whole style of shooting, you know, now, well, even nowadays I see, you know, the crew around us now, you got a sound person, you got a lighting person, you got a cameraman, a director, a production assistant, but in those days it was the cameraman. It was a one-man band, and like me and or JD, and that was it. And it was a smash-and-grab television. We're making it up as we went along. You know, the camera would be rolling before the rock star even opened his hotel room door. So we got, you know, that, as Moses called it, the living movie, just life as it unfolded. And that style of television certainly set the tone for MTV and the way music was covered for, you know, decades later. We pioneered it. It was wonderful. It was incredible. I wasn't a music journalist. I didn't consider myself that. I wasn't even really an expert. I was a fan. And I think maybe that's why the show worked too, because it was never too esoteric. It was just, you know, a big fan of rock and roll, covering it, you know, because I was passionate about it and getting along famously with all these bands. And some of them were just not, they didn't even know, the musicians at the time, how to behave on camera. They hadn't even invented their on-air personas yet. We were the first ones to break them in. It was great.
That's fabulous. And then that sort of, as you mentioned with Moses Neimer, I mean, that was, you know, and I don't think we've treated him yet in our history properly for how visionary he is. And that's the trouble, I think, a lot of times with Canadians, is we tend to not want to celebrate, you know, these mad geniuses. And I mean mad in the sense that there's no boundaries, there's no limits. Tell me what it was like to be at the sort of the ground floor of what clearly is, I think, Canada, one of Canada's great moments, and how that manifested into arguably our most successful show we've ever produced and exported around the world, which is Fashion Television. So take us to that, because this is shows about rebranding and reinventing, making it, and finding the moment and say, I'm going to own that moment.
So after about 6 years of doing the new music, which then, you know, grew into Much Music, and I was, you know, one of the founding members of that, and that was pretty cool. I started thinking around about 1985, you know, if I have to interview Rod Stewart once more, I'm going to lose it. You know, the time to look for the next big thing. You know, I was just, I sort of had it with the music thing. I didn't really like where music was going. I mean, music was, to me, in the late 70s and that whole second British invasion and the whole new wave punk thing. And that was like such exciting times. And, you know, the early 80s were great. But by the mid 80s, I was just, you know, it was a bit of a snore. And I didn't, you know, I didn't want to grow old in my vinyl jeans, even though I still do wear vinyl jeans to this day. But I thought, okay, what's the next big thing? And I heard that there was a show being planned by this young promo producer at City TV by the name of Jay Levine. He wanted to do a fashion video show because some fashion videos had started to be produced. Fashion industry thinking maybe these videos would do for the fashion industry what music videos did for the music industry. But the fashion videos are different because they're kind of short-lived, you know. After the next season, it's old news. But at any rate, we needed a vehicle for these videos, and they thought maybe they would hire a girl, like a fashion VJ, a model. And anyway, I heard about a show of this nature kind of being planned, or they were going to do a pilot for it at City TV. And I remember walking into the City TV building, this was when it was on Queen Street East, one day, and there were like, you know, 30 hot young women there, like, you know, with their little portfolios, you know, vying for this position to host this fashion video show. And I thought, for freak's sake, if anyone's paid their dues at this station, if anyone deserves a chance to go on and pioneer a whole other thing, it's me. And I marched up to the station manager's door and demanded that they consider me for the role. And they went, well, yeah, but we don't want to interview designers and we don't want any talking heads. This is just a sexy show about like street fashion. I said, I don't care what it is. I think you should be interviewing designers and we'll do with them what we did with the rock stars. But whatever you want to do, I'm there. You got to give me this chance to do it. I paid my dues, blah, blah, blah. They said, okay. And finally they let me host the pilot show. And after that first pilot, they said, you know what, we should do maybe interviews with designers. And so for the second show, we went to New York and interviewed Bob Mackie and Betsy Johnson. And we did a big story on the Boys from Roots. And, you know, all of a sudden we got behind the scenes and we presented this show magazine style, very much in the tone of the new music that became fashion television. And we were the first to really cover fashion as entertainment. Because I wasn't asking, you know, what about the silhouette, darling, or what about the hemlines or the shade of beige? You know, I was asking about, you know, the creative energy and the passion and the creative process and just really looking at these incredible, iconic figures who were, you know, had like bigger egos than rock stars, if that was even possible.
And you know what I loved about it is I watched it over the years. I was so proud when I would go, and I did a lot of work in London, and you see it on television. And go, that's our show, and that's Jeannie Becker. And then it's how much those designers look forward to you. Over the years, you could tell that they were just very, that you were there because you had a sincerity about you. You weren't just talking about hemlines or why did you choose purple as the color of the season. And I thought that was a really, that seems to be lost sometimes nowadays in the sense that it's this snackable content as opposed to maybe, you know, what you did is you actually said, I want to know what's inside your head and what's inside your heart.
I think they all really appreciated my enthusiasm. I think a lot of them had been asked the same old questions, you know, and the inspiration for this season, you know. And I was asking questions that were a little bit different, you know, off the beaten track. You know, I was in that fashion world, but I was never of that fashion world. And I think they appreciated that.
And so, you know, all the incredible people you've interviewed, and some have gone on and become billionaires and, you know, their businesses purchased and stuff. What do you think is the best attribute? Is it a business-minded designer or is it a creative-minded business person? Does that make sense?
Like I was. It totally makes sense. The question totally makes sense. Let me ask you this. Are you talking about success?
Somebody that had business success.
Because they're two very different things, Tony.
Well,
I mean, when they work in tandem.
Somebody
okay,
that's
hallelujah.
Happy that their body of work is being appreciated and worn and out there. As an artist, I think you can get a lot of satisfaction creating a painting, but I think you can also get a lot of satisfaction if somebody buys that painting and appreciates it.
Yeah. So. Sadly, I met many brilliantly creative designers in the fashion world that sadly just could not go on unless they had rich daddies or, you know, that uncle that was, you know, footing the bill because it's an expensive business to be in. And how can you possibly go on if you don't have a market? You know, so that I really think the most successful brands, let's call them, or labels, certainly the most successful designers are the ones that have the savvy to team up with a great business mind. You know, when you think of Valentino, and his partner Giancarlo Giometti, that, you know, or when I think of Yves Saint Laurent, you know, and Pierre Berger, you know, they're always, you know, a collaboration of that business, you know, right brain, left brain thing. I don't think many people are capable of, you know, really being split down the middle.
So it's interesting that you are, I would say, an early pioneer of what I'm seeing now with celebrities that no longer just want to be sing for their supper, they want to own the diner. And what I mean by that is they go from realizing talent has a shelf life, but if I can start monetizing my talent by having equity, skin in the game. And I look at you, and after fashion television, where most people would say, you're kind of, that was a great run, you know, you've probably, your body of work in the last 20 years has been incredible. I mean, an author, six books with the seventh coming out?
The sixth one's
it's coming
out.
Five books, the sixth coming out. You know, you've got your own television show, you've had your own brands. I mean, What lessons in life can you give people in the audience to say, have some ownership, have some skin in the game, but don't just be someone where they're going to pull a string on the neck and ask you to talk, but...
Well, one thing, and, you know, although some might accuse me of shredding myself too thin, but I think you sort of really got to have your fingers in a lot of pies. I really don't think you could ever rely on one thing, you know, all your eggs in one basket. Like, not, that is definitely not a cool thing to do. So I've always had lots of stuff going on. It also excites me and keeps me interested. And if, you know, if one project doesn't go so well, well, there's another great one that you can focus on. You have to sort of herd all these projects and make sure that you're giving them, the right amounts of energy and you're pouring your passion into all of them equally. But I definitely would be very scared if I thought I only had one thing and that was it. I mean, there's so many offshoots of these things. You know, one thing leads into another, one thing inspires another.
But is that your superpower, your Achilles heel, that you've got, you always have a million plates spinning? Like, have you ever thought back and said, if I had just picked three? Because every time I turn around, and we're going to tease something at the end of the yet another thing that you're doing, do you say, no, that's just, I just love those plates spinning?
Darling, je regret rien. You know, I really don't ever look back and say, maybe I should have done this or I shouldn't have done that. Certainly not in terms of my career. I mean, the only thing that maybe sometimes I think, should I have done it? But I understand why I didn't do it was I should have moved to the States and relocated the way so many people did because they made a whack load more money than I ever would being here in Canada. That being said, I think I've had a pretty grounded life here in Canada, a fabulous life. I think it was, you know, great for my kids. I'm a really proud Canadian. This is, you know, where I wanted to make my mark. And I did manage to have an international career out of my own backyard. I don't think many people can say that. So I, you know, pat myself on the back for that one. But I don't think, you know, did I spread myself? Do you think, did I try to do too much? Damn, I've got way more stuff that I want to do still. You know, like, I'm, you know, 71. I just like, whoa, I feel like in some ways I've only just begun. Have I really even scratched the surface yet? There's so much out there that's alluring to me.
How did you manage to do it all and also have two daughters that absolutely adore you? Every picture I see with you. You know, whether your daughter who spent 10 years off the grid in the Yukon, musician, I mean, your other daughter's got her own animation studio. But they're like, because you must have been absent a lot. I mean, you were all over the world.
I cried myself to sleep in hotel rooms all around the world. Many years in my so-called glamorous life. And that is something that any working mother can relate to, I know. But I knew I had to be true to myself. I was not gonna give up. I wanted it all. I mean, yeah. I don't know, I wanted it all. I mean, was I crazy for trying to have it all? I mean, you know, do my kids resent me for that? You know, I hope they appreciate the fact that I worked as hard as I did and now I can help them realize a lot of their dreams because I did work as hard as I worked. My husband left when the girls were like 8 and 10, very unexpectedly. I was like gobsmacked, like flabbergasted, like hit by a Mack truck. I was madly in love with him and he just left without much notice. I think a couple weeks notice. It was like, what? You don't want to be married anymore? Okay. And I raised those girls, you know, mostly by myself. You know, he was there, you know, every other weekend and Wednesdays or however that worked. But I was just determined to try and have it all. And I still am. And I still try to dance as fast as I can, even on days when I'm not really necessarily feeling my best, but I fight to stay in the light.
So let's talk about your health. I mean, you had breast cancer, mm-hmm. and a lot of celebrities would say, I'm not gonna tell anybody because they're gonna think I'm damaged goods. It's fair. They're gonna think that I haven't got the capability to work the way I used to. And you went the other way. You stepped in front and said, I have this audience, I have this spotlight, I'm gonna shine it on the people that helped me survive, mm-hmm. And I admire you for that. But that, I mean, you obviously have never had the agent, you know, the Colonel Sanders saying, whispering in your ear, because that was a, that was an interesting position.
Tony, first of all, I understand why some people keep that kind of stuff private. Believe me, that's their business, and that's fine. I would feel like the absolute hypocrite of the century if, after having, you know, revealed myself and, like, you know, I was a syndicated newspaper columnist, magazine columnist for years, always writing about my personal life, wrote all books about myself, just told everyone, you know, whoever wanted to listen. You know, my mother used to say, you have to tell everything. But yes, I do, because I'm a communicator, and I want to communicate, and I want to be someone that people can, you know, relate to and maybe glean something from. And the most precious thing that we can give one another, that's our own personal stories, right? So for me, that was just the way I saw the world. So when this diagnosis came to me, you know, it was like, well, I'm just gonna have to tell everybody. I was also holding the hand of a very dear friend just a year leading up to my own diagnosis, who had breast cancer, who didn't want to tell anybody. And I saw what a burden it was to keep this to herself, and she was trying to keep it secret. I thought, nope, I'm gonna let it all hang out here and tell people what I have. And very early on, I got a note. I started getting millions of notes, comments, messages, DMs from all these Instagram followers. My Instagram following doubled overnight. And one woman said to me, you know, I've just been diagnosed with breast cancer too, and I'm choosing to look at this as an opportunity disguised as an inconvenience. And I thought, damn, what a great way of looking at it. Is it inconvenient? Absolutely. I have all these projects. Am I going to be able to do them? What's going to happen when my hair falls out? And how am I going to... But still, I thought, this is going to make me a better person. There's no question, going through a journey like that, it's got to make me a bigger, better, braver, stronger, bolder, wiser person. And so it did. And Tony, it opened up so many new doors for me and a whole other platform. And now I can go and speak to, yeah, of course I can speak to people about fashion. I always will, because I love fashion and it's a hoot and it's fabulous. But that being said, there's a little more gravitas with something like cancer, or something like just even, you know, staying in the light and fighting fear and all those things that you need to do in order to really survive and remain in a good headspace. And when I get up and talk to people now, and I'm being asked to, you know, speak all over the country, and it's just the biggest joy to connect with people in that way. It is so meaningful. It's been fabulous. It's been great. It's added a whole other dimension to my career.
And so you've got your sixth book coming out, and is it more on Jeannie? Like, what angle are you going to take now?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's Simon & Schuster, the wonderful Kevin Hansen, who runs it, Simon & Schuster Canada. When they came to me, I thought, oh, okay, they're probably wanting me to write a book about my cancer journey. He goes, no. I think he very flatteringly said, you know, I think you're a very wise person, and I think you've got a lot of life lessons to teach people. And now, how are we going to tell this story? And we started talking, and I was working with a brilliant editor, Nita Prose, or Nita Pronovos is her real name, her pen name, Nita Prose, who's now the best-selling author of these books, The Maid and The Mystery Guest. I don't know if you've heard of her. She's brilliant. She was my editor at Simon & Schuster. And we concocted this idea of telling an assortment of short stories about my life through the lens of fashion, because that's how people know me. And each story starts with a piece of clothing or an accessory or a piece of jewelry, and it spins into why I chose that for my wardrobe, why I had that, what it meant to me, where I wore it, who I met when I wore it, the experience I had, the encounter I had, the life lesson learned from that person that I was wearing that outfit that I was. I mean, it's a fun kind of book that I think will make people realize that our wardrobes really are touchstones for so many incredible memories, and we all have these fond memories of things that we put on our bodies, and they're kind of the silent witnesses to our lives, the clothing that we wear, and they say so much about us, and they tell us so much about ourselves.
So the American Marketing Association, I mean, it just does this incredible job. I'm going to talk mentorship and just cultivating this sense of destiny with youth, that they believe that there's opportunity out there. What life lessons from your new book can you offer, just maybe one life lesson from your new book, that you say, if I could just give that to the youth, I think that would give them the superpower?
I mean, I just say open mind and open heart always. You know, I mean, I think you just have to be open. You have to create your own opportunities. You have to be resilient. I mean, the world is your oyster. There's so many lessons. I can't really think one that you really have to, but you know.
I think open your mind and open your heart. It's a beautiful.
Or maybe it's my dad's old lesson of don't be afraid and never give up, you know, because that runs through my life as well. Yeah.
So I'm hearing whispers of yet another Jeannie Becker project, and this one, instead of just being editors of magazines, which you've done, and I guess it's a yawn, and having an international television show in 4,000 countries, yawn, it's now, you're there, and I don't know how much you're willing to share, but I hear rumors of curating this fashion museum exhibit.
And curating, co-curating, actually, a wonderful exhibit. With the Glenbow, which is a fabulous museum that will reopen its doors in 2026. They're currently undergoing a $200 million renovation. It's smack dab in the heart of Calgary. It's an incredible art museum, and we're doing a big fashion-related exhibition that will be very personal for me. And I'm just thrilled that they even wanted to do it. This was nothing I pitched. Again, you know, they came to me and it was like, what? You really want to do that? And I think it will have a lot of lessons and hoping to just inspire the next generation through it.
And my last question for you is that one day we're both going to run on a runway and your daughters are going to be sitting talking to each other about their mom. What do you hope they say?
She tried her best. She was kind and supported our dreams.
It's a beautiful way to do it. You know, Jeannie, I always end with my three takeaways, and I always, like, it's like drinking from a fire hose with you, but I love the fact that the most important lesson that, and you always reference your mom and your dad, but this sense of dreaming and doing and how they manifested with their different personalities. You said I'm half one and half the other, and they let you go off and do crazy things, and I think your second lesson is open your mind and open your heart. I think so often we try to follow this road in life because that's what we want, especially nowadays with Instagram and Facebook. We want to be self-important and go, look how far we're going. And I think your advice to young people and to anybody is just like follow your passion, follow your heart, and take on as many things as you can and get your fingers in as many pies as you can. But I guess the last lesson for all of us, because there's few that'll be watching this, so we'll ever have the success you've had from 0 to 100 miles an hour, and it sounds like at 71 you're still going 120 miles an hour now, but you do so with humility, you do so with grace, you do so with humor, and for all of that, and just thank you for joining us, and you're just such a delight, and I've missed you, and I can't believe we haven't seen each other since before COVID.
Thank you so much, Tony. Love you to bits. Always great having a conversation with you.
Well, that's fabulous. Thank you. 2008, something very special happened to me. I was inducted into the Canada's Marketing Hall of Legends. It's one of the proudest moments of my career because my family was there, one of the proudest moments of my life. You see, in this hall are people that have put a dent in the marketplace. We have visionaries who came up with ideas. We have business builders that not only established their brand in Canada, but around the world. We have stewards of brands who found a way to engage the head and heart and hands of the consumer and the media. We have leaders and creators that build campaigns that dance all over media. This is more than the Hall of Legends. When you think about it, it's the Hall of Learning. Imagine the intellectual resource that exists within it. The lessons in life, the journey, the overcoming circumstances, the tightropes, the way they reinvented and reimagined the world. The American Marketing Association's Toronto chapter came up with this idea of curating this learning. And what they've done is they've created the Legends Journey, Lessons in Leadership. We're gonna take some of the people that are in this hall, spend some time interviewing them, draw out what they bring not only to your livelihood, but ideally to your life. So thank you for being part of Lessons in Leadership and the Legends Journey. It's Tony Chapman. Thanks for listening. Let's chat soon.